Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hey friends, welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. So we're going to jump right into some headlines today, bring the mind of Christ to bear. Hopefully, each one of us can then go out into the world that God so loves with the very mind of Christ, and be gospel people speaking the truth in ways that actually honor Jesus. So that's always our goal here each and every day on Connecting Faith, and that's what we're going to do right now. So I've got a headline here out of California related to Greg Laurie. Now, we have had Greg Laurie here on Connecting Faith. He is a pastor and he is an evangelist, and he runs these harvest events across the country. And we have had conversations about the Harvest Crusade in 2018 here on Connecting Faith. So this is in relationship to that. So the headline is Sign of the Times, Pastor Greg Laurie forced to remove billboards featuring the Bible. Now, that's a little bit misleading because the billboards don't really feature the Bible. They're sort of a filtered and stylized graphic that's drawn from a photograph of Greg Laurie holding a microphone in one hand and what you is allegedly a Bible in the other hand, but nowhere does the word Bible appear on the book that he is holding up in his other hand. And so I even think that the headline suggesting that the billboards feature the Bible or that the graphic representation is even necessarily a Bible, which even if it is, why is that offensive and cause to remove a billboard from a public space? So Greg and Harvest Crusade have been forced to take down a series of billboards advertising the upcoming Harvest Outreach, which is going to be held at Angel Stadium, August 17th to 19th, in the greater Atlanta, in the greater LA region. It's expected to draw tens of thousands of people. The Irvine Company agreed to post large billboards promoting the crusade at a prestigious outdoor mall in Orange County called Fashion Island. For those of you in Newport Beach, you know what I'm talking about. So they claim, Irvine Company claimed that they received multiple complaints about the religious imagery, and one person perceived it as a serious threat. And so the Irvine Company originally asked that they would modify the signage, which they offered to do, Harvest offered to do, but those modifications were rejected, and ultimately the management made use of a provision in the contract that reads, management reserves the right not to display any materials that could be construed as vulgar or offensive. Vulgar or offensive. So, and a serious threat. One person viewed it as a serious threat. So this is a filtered, stylized picture of Greg Laurie holding a microphone in one hand and a book in the other hand. That is what has, in the culture, apparently risen to the level of threatening speech, so much so that it is regarded as vulgar and offensive and therefore must be removed so that no one walking through Fashion Square in Newport Beach, California would, have anything other than the opportunity to be fully consumeristic, I guess. I mean, is the Bible, what form of threat is the Bible, even if that is what he's holding in the picture, which you'd never be able to prove. Now, Harvest is on the record saying that this has less to do with the company because they don't want the Irvine Company to experience any negative response to this, but more to do with what's described as the culture. Well, I actually think it reflects a certain lack of moral courage on the part of whoever caved in on this. Whoever caved in on this, that's... We have to have more moral courage than this, my friends, in the world in which we now live. And so that would be my encouragement here. Don't take down the sign. Actually raise your voice. Raise concern that the public square is actually an environment in which there should be a free exchange of ideas. Yes, certainly the free exchange of ideas should be thoughtful and courteous and respectful to all viewpoints. But the fact that a billboard includes a filtered and stylized graphic image. And when I say graphic, I don't mean it's like, it's not graphic artwork. It's just that it looks like it's a pencil drawing. It's not a photograph. of a person holding a square object, rectangular object that might be a book and therefore might be a Bible is a little bit crazy. And so I just think we have to be willing to stand up and say, no, we're not taking these billboards down. If you actually want to somehow prove that this is offensive speech, then let's have that conversation. It also penalizes all of the musical artists who were advertised on the sign as well. And, you know, so how will people know that Mercy Me is going to be out there performing at the Harvest Outreach at Angel Stadium August 17th to 19th? So, yeah, there you go. There's a little free advertising on Connecting Faith. Hopefully the free advertising they're going to get replaces the penalty of having to pull down the signage. My next headline piece is actually out of Hollywood. It's about Scarlett Johansson. This article that I'm going to draw from appears in the New York Times, but this is actually being fairly widely covered by media that concerns itself with Hollywood and the things of Hollywood. So please, in no way, shape, or form, do I want you to take this as any kind of recommendation that any of us should ever see the movie that I'm now about to talk about. There has been a newly announced movie called Rub and Tug. And they announced that they had cast Scarlett Johansson in the lead role. And so Scarlett Johansson, who is a female actor, what we would have traditionally called an actress, was going to take the role of this transgendered man, Dante Gill, who's also known as Tex, who apparently ran a string of massage parlors back in the 70s and 80s that became fronts for prostitution. Here's what Scarlett Johansson said. She says, "While I would have loved the opportunity to bring Dante's story and transition to life, I understand why many feel he should be portrayed by a transgender person." Let's just stop right there. Article, the conversations raised in this article center around the ethical questions. Ethical questions. No one in here is asking ethical questions about a string of massage parlors that became fronts for prostitution dens run by a person who went through gender transition. The ethical questions being raised in the article, particularly by organizations like Out Magazine, the ethical questions being raised surround whether or not a female actress, cisgender, which means that her gender identity aligns with her biological sex, here we're talking about Scarlett Johansson, should be cast in a role of a transgender man. Because they argue that marginalizes transgender actors. Okay, so here's what I would like to equip you with today. We need to be asking ethical questions about these kinds of movies. We need to be asking ethical questions about the content of these kinds of movies. We need to be asking ethical questions about massage parlors that are fronts for prostitution. Absolutely. But I want you to note the accusation that hiring an actress to play a man means that an opportunity was taken away from a transgender actor. I want you to think about that for a moment. If Scarlett Johansson was the best actor to play Dante Gill, then she is the person who should play the role. I mean, we could have a whole argument about whether or not the movie should be made at all. But if they're going to make the movie, they should have the right to cast whomever they want in whatever role they want to cast. Everyone else but the person who gets hired, everyone else is marginalized. That's how casting works. And then let me ask this. If only transgender people can play transgender roles, which let's remember here, we're talking about acting. The whole point is to take on roles and characters and characteristics that you don't possess. That's the whole concept of acting. But if it's going to be argued that only transgender people can play transgender roles, then in order to be logically consistent, we should absolutely expect that only cisgender people should be cast in cisgender roles. You should never cast a gay, lesbian, transgender, bisexual, queer, or otherwise identified person in any role that is representing or playing a person who is cisgender. So that would be logically consistent, but that does not align with the agenda being promoted here. And then one more thing before we go to the break. We often talk about the redefinition of words and the repurposing of images in our culture today. Words matter. Language matters. We've talked about marriage and its redefinition, gender and the attempt to redefine it, the rainbow and its repurposing as an image. So I want to talk really briefly here about the word church, what it means and what constitutes a legitimate church. And I raise this concern because there was an interesting article in an unlikely place on the Forbes tax blog. I know now you're thinking she is a total geek and reads stuff that I can't even imagine I would ever read. On the Forbes tax blog, there is an article about the IRS approving the church status of an organization whose first word I will not say on the air. But it ends in a description of Church of Modern Witchcraft. So we are going to call it by its acronym, which is PCMW, the something, which I will not say, Church of Modern Witchcraft. They have been approved as a, not just a 501c3 religious nonprofit, but as a church, which gives them very special status here in the United States in terms of information that they have to report and things that they have to file. So not only are they tax exempt, but they're also exempt from having to file what's called a 990, which other religious nonprofits have to file. Here's what is stunning and staggering about this. This on the website of this PCMW, they list their membership criteria and their leadership criteria. And I just want to go on the record as saying, if any conservative Christian organization listed these kinds of parameters for membership and leadership on their websites, people would fall over in the public square. But because this is an organization restricted just to feminists who understand themselves to be witches, their membership criteria can be whatever they define themselves to be. So here's the membership criteria. You have to be a woman who is defined here as an adult female human, or a girl, a minor female human. And then the, again, acronym, PCMW, because they serve women and girls only. Males are not permitted to participate regardless of how they identify. We expressly reject the concepts of gender identity, transgenderism, and gender as being meaningful to define what a woman or girl is, which means they don't accept people who are transgender. This is women and girls only. So we're going to have to circle back around to this story, because I think that when we start talking about the leadership criteria that they're using, it's instructive for those of us in sort of conservative branches of Christianity in the U.S. today to actually use these really good legal examples of extreme churches that we wouldn't define as churches at all, but that the law defines as churches in our culture. All right, I got to take a quick break. But when I come back, I'm going to be having a conversation with Josh Brom. Josh wants us to be thinking about and engaging in what he calls relational apologetics, particularly when it comes to the pro-life debates in our culture today. So stick with me. You are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBurge. We'll be right back.
Let them see you.
Hey, friends, that's really our heart's desire, that when people see us, when they hear us, they would see and hear Jesus represented well in the world today and in the conversations of our day. I am joined today by Josh Brom. He's the president of the Equal Rights Institute, and it's Josh's passion to help pro-life people be more persuasive when we communicate with pro-choice people in the culture. So, Josh, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
So I actually want to start with the name of your organization, because it seems strategic to me.
Oh, yes, it is.
So just talk with me about that.
Yeah. So there were a couple of things going on. So one thing going on is one of the reasons we started ERI is because we wanted to teach pro-life people the personhood argument that we sort of stumbled on, that we found to change way more pro-choice minds than anything we tried before. And we call that the equal rights argument. But another thing going on was just thinking big picture, you know, which movement has been more effective in the last 20 years, the pro-life movement or the gay rights movement? I think clearly the latter. And so Going with a name that would be a little bit harder, for example, for the IRS to, you know, be like, oh no, we're gonna hold this off. This was right around the time of that scandal. We wanted something that people need to get to know us a little bit before they give kind of an immediate judgment on us. For the same reason, there's not a cross in our logo. Like we're Christians, but you got to get to know us a little bit before you kind of do an initial judgment on us.
So if folks want to check it out, it's equalrightsinstitute.com. And it's one of the things I really like about it is obviously it's even a website designed for maybe kind of next gen people.
Yes.
Right. You seem to be I'm not saying you're not interested in sort of re-educating those of us who are already old. but there definitely seems to me to be an emphasis on and an attention toward the next generation. Tell me why.
Our target demographic is absolutely high school and college students, although I love it when adults are interested in what we're learning. And there's a few reasons for that. When we started Equal Rights Institute, we wanted to create a flexible and innovative apologetic organization. And so when we're going out onto campuses, that's our lab. We're doing R&D. We're trying different things. And sometimes we try things that fail miserably, and then sometimes we try things that work really well. So we're trying to figure out what is actually changing minds right now. For the young pro-choice atheist college students, what arguments are the most likely to actually change their mind? And so when we go into an audience of older adults, and I do this sometimes, and sometimes kind of the eyes glaze over, and they're maybe a little bit frustrated that there's this 34-year-old that's telling them, hey, let me tell you the things that you ought to say. Like sometimes there's a little bit of not a great reaction to that. But if I go to, you know, if I go to the Students for Life conference and 3,000 college students are there and I tell them, look, our staff has cumulatively had 5,000 conversations with pro-choice people. We've learned a bunch of things. We've learned from our own mistakes. Let me tell you some of the things that we've learned. They're on the edge of their seat. They're just like, they just want to soak up everything that we've learned. And so that's part of it. And then another thing is for me, I want to help the pro-life movement to become more effective. I'm not an anti-pro-life movement person. It's kind of cool for young pro-life leaders right now to be like, you know, I hate the pro-life movement. We just need to like burn it down and start over. That's not my view. There's a lot of wonderful things in the pro-life movement. Do we have kind of a cringy friend's edge? Yes. Could we get better at communicating with pro-choice people? Absolutely. And so I want to help people do that. And my strategy is a long-term one. If I get to high school and college students now who are going to take over the pro-life movement in 20, 30 years and train them out of their bad habits before they develop them, then in the long term, we're going to actually have a more effective movement.
So I love this approach. Even just in the way that you talk about what you're doing, I hope that that's instructive to our listeners. Like I am hearing you say, hey, I go somewhere and I am sharing with other people what we're learning.
Yeah.
And you talk about going onto college campuses, seeking out conversations with pro-choice students, which is actually, if we would take the time to do so, the overwhelming majority on most secular college campuses today.
Absolutely.
And what you're saying is I'm actually there to find out what they think, why they think what they think, and how their minds might be changed. I'm not going there assuming I know how to change their minds and then whip out that weapon of whatever it is and slay them with it.
Right.
Right. So even just in the way that you are sharing with us about what you do, we're learning. Right. And so we talk about here conversational apologetics.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about relational apologetics.
Yeah.
Conversational apologetics can actually be a one-off, right?
Yes.
Relational apologetics must of necessity not be a one-off.
By definition, yeah.
By definition. So talk with us about relational apologetics.
Yeah. So this started for me about, let me say, 6-7 years ago. Up until then, all of my conversations with pro-choice people were at best 2 hours long on a college campus somewhere. And some really great conversations, and I've seen people change their minds, and it's all awesome. And then I got invited into this secret Facebook debate group thing. And it sounds really clandestine. It wasn't. This is what Facebook calls them. You can't, like, find it. You got to be invited in. And so I spent a year in this group, most of that time with only about 20 people, most of whom were pro-choice or a few pro-lifers. And that really affected me. Like in the beginning, I just saw it as like kind of a social experiment. I could kind of see what makes these people tick. Like I still remember Jessica and Ronnie and Kara and Kira is a different person, and how, and like we would sometimes invite other pro-lifers in. A lot of times they would end up making everyone mad and they get kicked out. And so I'd be able to see, okay, some of the things that I've done and my friend Chris has done was fine. But these other things that I wouldn't have maybe thought were that offensive, like, didn't work. And so I just started thinking, like, some people need more than one conversation to change their mind. In fact, most people need more than one conversation to change their mind about an important thing, including us. Like, if I, you know, hung out with, like, Sam Harris, he'd crane me in a debate. He's super smart. It doesn't mean that I should change my mind right away. I should go and find, like, look at what William Lane Craig would say in response to that, or my pastor, or whatever. So that just got me thinking about pro-choice people in a different way. It actually helped me to humanize pro-choice people better, which is something that I think a lot of pro-life people struggle with sometimes. We're always humanizing the unborn, but then when we talk about pro-choice people, we dehumanize them. So then I just started having friendships with pro-choice people, and some of those friendships are still ongoing. Some of them are 5-6 years long now, and I've seen people change their mind over the course of that. But then it's not just me. Like, when I go around, a few of the stories that I've been telling lately, Daryl Davis is this one. He's awesome. There's this documentary on Netflix about him. I forget what it's called, but if you search Daryl Davis, you'll find him. He's a black blues pianist. He's amazing. He used to play with Chuck Berry. Like, I was a professional pianist for a while, and I can't touch what this guy can do when he gets to a piano. But that's not why he's famous. Daryl Davis is famous because he befriends KKK members and gets them out of the Klan as the result of this, because it's pretty hard to stay a racist when you become really good friends with a black guy. And so he'll just invite these KKK members to lunch. It's always his white female assistant that invites these guys. She doesn't say who it is. They assume it must be a white guy, because what white woman would work for a black guy, right? Like, that's just their assumption. And then they show up, and there's Daryl Davis, like, hey, welcome. Because he grew up wanting to ask racists, how can you hate me when you don't even know me? And now I think the number is over 50 guys that have left the Klan, including, like, state leaders. And they'll give him their old robe and hood. I think he's collected, like, 50 of these. And then you've got Megan Phelps, who used to be at Westboro Baptist Church. And she left because – and there's a TED Talk by her about this, but she was on their Twitter team. I didn't know Westboro Baptist Church had a Twitter, presence, but they did. And so then there would be obviously people being obnoxious and kind of hateful, but then some people were asking legit questions. How can you, do these things when these Bible verses say kind of these contradicting things? And then she got stumped. She'd go to her mom, and her mom would have no good answer, would just kind of write it off. And then these certain Twitter people, started actually finding where they were going to do their next protest and would show up and meet with them. And so as a result, she ended up leaving the church and marrying one of them. And so my thing is, if a KKK people can leave the KKK, if someone can leave Westboro Baptist Church as a result of relationships with thoughtful, winsome people, anybody could leave any issue as a result of that kind of a friendship.
All right, so I love this, and I love this approach. Friends, we got to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Josh Brom. He's the president of the Equal Rights Institute. In the meantime, you can check out what they're doing at equalrightsinstitute.com. I'm Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. We'll be right back. Hey, friends, you are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Welcome back. Continuing my conversation with Josh Brom, president of the Equal Rights Institute. You can check it out at equalrightsinstitute.com. So, Josh, you spend a lot of time on college campuses in particular talking with young people who are pro-choice. You've discovered a lot about why they think what they think, and you've also discovered what works in terms of changing hearts and minds. Share with us a couple of those very practical, relational, conversational, apologetics approaches that actually work to change pro-choice minds.
Yeah, so the argument that is, that changes more minds by far, like the second place winner, and we might do that if we have time, it's not even a close second. It's like at the end of our outreaches, we'll have debrief sessions, we'll sit around in a circle somewhere in the grass and just talk about our days, and it's always the same thing. Someone's like, hey, I saw someone become pro-life today. It's like, cool, how'd that happen? Oh, I used the equal rights argument. Like, it's the same, it's second verse, same as the first. Like, this is really affected people. I think because we're focusing on equality, which is what the millennial generation cares about more than just about anything. We're actually purposely taking a little break from talking about abortion and getting them in touch with this thing that they care maybe more about, and basically showing them that if they're going to be pro-equality, they have to be pro-life, and put them in this kind of an internal conflict with which one am I going to be. So the way that this works out, and this didn't originally come from us, this is a Dr. J.P. Moreland argument, this brilliant philosopher at Biola that my brother Tim and a friend of mine, Steve Wagner, spent a lot of time kind of modifying for use on campus. But just to practically how this works out, in fact, I'll tell you in his story. So we're at UC Davis a couple of years ago. Our favorite campus to do outreach at. They were so mad that we were there. We got totally protested. Our stuff got vandalized. It was a whole thing. But before things got kind of nuts, I'm talking to these three pro-choice girls. And they kind of vented at me for a while, and I'm just listening and kind of taking that in. And then, to her credit, one of them asked me, "All right, I want to know why you're here. Why are you here on campus?" And I said, "I think I could explain to you why I'm pro-life in about 2 minutes." He said, "Go." I'm like, "What would you do at those 2 minutes?" Right. So what I did, I said, "I'm a very open-minded person. I'm a very uncomfortable person. I hold most of my views with a pretty open hand. I've changed my mind about lots of important things as I've learned new things. But one of the things that it would be the hardest for you to change my mind on is this, is that everyone that I can see right now has an equal right to life." So we're outside the quad at UC Davis. It's near where people have lunch. You can see about 200 people right now. So I said, like, around here, everyone that I can see has an equal right to life. It's like a gut. It's like so obvious. I almost don't think I should even have to argue for that. But that's kind of weird, isn't it? Because we have all these differences. I see some tall people. I see some short people. I see some people who are really smart. I see some people who are, trying their best. Like, you've got people who are good at sports and music and those that are not. How can we possibly explain this idea that we all agree on? Like, everyone in Western civilization basically agrees we all have an equal right to life. How can we explain that when there are so many differences? Now, usually here I would stop and let them respond, but she only gave me 2 minutes, so I kept going. I gave her my answer. I said, I think it's got to be that we all have something in common. And this is key. It's got to be something that we all have equally. So it's got to be like a light switch. It can't be like a dimmer switch, or it won't explain equality. It can't be like intelligence, because some people are more intelligent than others. So,
or physical ability.
Or something like that. So what could that thing be? I said, I think, and I'm giving a slightly simplistic answer for her sake, just so we don't get into the weeds of a really philosophical thing. But I basically said, I think it's humanness. I think we have humanness in common. And that's an all or nothing kind of a thing. You're not part human. And so if that's the right answer to this question, if that's why everyone I can see right now gets an equal right to life, and if the unborn have that, and they totally do, then we should give them an equal right to life regardless of what our gut instinct is about it. And the last thing I said before I stopped was, notice something about my argument. This is not a religious argument, and it's also not an emotional argument. I'm not pro-life for emotional reasons. I'm not pro-life, like, I don't get the warm fuzzies when I look at a picture of a zygote. I don't. It looks like a fuzzy orange to me. I'm not pro-life for emotional reasons. I'm pro-life because it is the most rational conclusion I can come to. Because I'm not reasoning backwards like a lot of people do, where it's like, hey, I know what view I want to have, so how can I walk backwards and figure out the syllogism that'll work? No, that's terrible. You don't want to do that. You make all kinds of mistakes. I'm starting with equality as premise one and reasoning from there. And I have not yet heard a good reason to discriminate against the unborn and yet let everyone else have an equal right to life. I have never seen any other argument change more pro-choice minds on college campuses right now. Again, because they care so much about being a person who is pro-equality. Like, they value that about themselves, of being able to say, I care about equality. And so if we can put that into conflict with their pro-choice views, they will often choose being a pro-equality person over being pro-choice.
So that's excellent and provocative and persuasive. And what I also like about it is that you own it the whole time.
Hmm. What do you mean by that?
Well, everyone that I can see. You never in there made an assumption that she was agreeing with you.
Right.
Now, again, if we had a longer time to spend with her, we might actually stop and say, can we agree that everyone that we can see right now has an equal right to life?
Right.
And particularly, I feel like if there's a very elderly person in view, this is a good conversation. If there is a person who is clearly physically disadvantaged or disabled in view, this is a very important conversation in the culture today.
Yeah.
You know, if a person lives beyond their perceived utility to the rest of us, do they still have a right to life?
Right.
Or if they are never going to physically be able to care for themselves and therefore be a contributing member of society, as we would see that in a utilitarian way, do they still have a right to life? And I think that most equal rights people will say yes. Those people still have a right to life.
Yeah.
We're not just going to start killing them. Or if we are, that's a whole different conversation, right?
Right, right. Like, what, we're purposely doing something in the beginning of that argument where we're just pointing to the most obvious case of persons, which is human adults. We're not putting the unborn in that list because then this would be a circular argument. So what we're doing is we're just like pointing to the most obvious case and kind of going from there. So then we could try to figure out what is going on deeper at a more metaphysical level with that really obvious case, and then try to apply what we learn about that to this less obvious case, the unborn. And we found that to work really well. And then, yeah, certainly, if they might respond, well, I don't think it's humanness. I think it's sentience. I think it's self-awareness. I think viability. I think, you know, all these different things, approach which people think matters. And then we can just respond. Those problems, those arguments all have at least one of two really big problems. And there's all kinds of ways you can respond. I would say this is the most persuasive that we've found. If they say something like sentient, which means they probably mean you got to be like minimally aware of the world around you, like some kind of like really low level of consciousness. And then you're in. Then you're in the, you know, the equal right to life circle. They've got a squirrel problem. Squirrels can do that. Like basically all animals can do this. So we'll just point at squirrels and just say, I think there's a problem because in this view, squirrels are equal to toddlers. And, you know, I don't think that's the world that I live in. Now, sometimes they will punt to like a new thing. They'll be like, they're trying to figure out where can they like put the fader in the exact right place where they get the view that they want. So they'll say, you got to be self-aware. You got to be able to know that you're a unique entity that will exist after time. Well, now you got a newborn problem. Newborns can't do that. And so they just can't find a way to get – like they basically want to say the unborn are out and everyone else is in, and they can't do that unless they kind of say, yeah, it's being human versus all these other kind of more arbitrary things that they will point out. And we have found that to change the most minds.
Okay, friends, so I know you're stimulated by this conversation. My conversation partner is Josh Brom. He is the president of the Equal Rights Institute. You can actually find more information out about this at equalrightsinstitute.com. You speak, you speak, you're talking now, but I mean, like, you share this in other environments.
Yeah.
You guys have events. You go to college campuses. I'm wondering a little bit about what you're experiencing out there in the culture, particularly on college campuses. We've talked a lot. We hear a lot about the hostility in terms of free speech or the engagement with ideas that might quote unquote trigger negative responses from some people.
Yeah.
Just talk with us about your experience.
Yeah, it's not a great place to be doing conservative stuff right now is college campuses. We haven't experienced the worst of it. We haven't had like a Ben Shapiro level, you know, like a protest. The UC Davis thing was the worst that we had. And in that case, our stuff got vandalized and one man was very physically threatening. I actually thought he was going to beat me up. And in the end, someone kind of pulled him away. That's the worst that we've had. Because we don't put graphic pictures on signs, which is a whole internal pro-life debate, we have them in a brochure, we use them with consent. But because we don't put them on our signs, our outreaches don't tend to get as rowdy as some others do. There is an event I'm doing soon that I'm a little bit concerned about. I'm speaking at Berkeley at this pro-life conference, and I found out that Berkeley Antifa just tweeted about it. And so I'm a little bit – that'll be interesting to see what happens there. I hope – hopefully no one gets hurt. But it's not the greatest place for free speech right now, and I'm basically hoping that we've seen the worst of it. I'm hoping that as people like – I'm really encouraged by people like Sam Harris. I listen to Sam Harris's podcast a lot, and he's very, very smart atheist philosopher. And he is very staunch on free speech rights.
Okay, so we have to pause because you just freaked some people out.
Yes.
Right?
I listen to an atheist.
Right. So you're a Christian,
yes.
And you're seeking to help Christians who are pro-life prepare themselves to have persuasive conversations and that actually might lead to the changing of hearts and minds. You are also listening in order to understand the other side of the conversation. So talk with us about why you are listening to a podcast by Sam Harris.
I want to understand what the smartest people who disagree with me from things have to say. I don't want to just pay attention to stupid leftist memes, because then I'm not really getting outside my echo chamber. I'm just finding bumper stickers I can make fun of. So I'm looking for the smartest people on all sides of any issue and trying to figure out what they have to say and then make a decision. I think Sam Harris is very intelligent. He's wrong about some things, but listening to him pushes me in the right way. This is part of my getting outside of confirmation bias. That's why I'm on Reddit every single day. I'm looking for intelligent articles that I wouldn't have come across my Facebook newsfeed. But I'm encouraged by Sam Harris because, again, a lot of young people love him. He's very interesting. He's funny. He's interesting, and he's very strong on free speech. And so I'm basically hoping that we'll see kind of a bigger surge from young, even leftists, saying, look, we've got to be able to agree free speech is important, because if it's either we can talk to each other or we can be violent, and that's no good. So we need to be able to talk to each other. So maybe we shouldn't be having Antifa or whatever trying to block people from hearing views that are different. I think everyone should be listening to the smartest people on the other side from them. So if you only listen to Fox News, that's a problem. If you're on the left and you only listen to MSNBC, same problem. So can you find those really smart people who are different from you on different issues? And yes, it's hard. I'll admit it's hard. Sometimes I don't have the energy for it. I'll come across a headline and it's like, I can't do this right now. I'm just going to go find a funny video. I do that sometimes. But we've also got to kind of build up this muscle of it's okay to grapple with views that are different from ours, even views that we can't refute right away. Maybe we've got to get deep into an issue, but it's the only reason I've ever changed my mind about anything was listening to smarter people who disagreed with me.
So let's do one more quick take on something before we wrap this up. Identify for us some faulty rhetoric. Tell us what doesn't work.
On which side? On the pro-life side?
On
or
our
the side.
Side. On the right. What are some things that we as pro-lifers say that actually build the wall between us instead of break down the barriers of conversation?
That's a good question. The big trend right now that I'm most worried about is this thing that people do where you are only pro-life if you agree with me on like five other issues. You got to be vegan. You got to be against capital punishment. You've got to have my views on international, conflict. And if you don't agree with me on all those things, then you're not truly pro-life. And usually this ends up being just a way of dismissing people who are against abortion. And there's a kernel of truth. There's a thing that they might be sometimes trying to get at and just not doing very well, which is something that we at ERI call fetus tunnel vision. This is this really obnoxious thing that pro-life people do sometimes where they cannot acknowledge that a thing or an event, a tragedy like 9/11 was horrible without also at the same time comparing it to abortion. 3,000 people died on 9/11, but do you know how many babies get killed at Planned Parenthood? Like that kind of thing. And that's not good. We shouldn't do that because then it seems like we don't have a working moral compass. It doesn't seem like we can see that there is more than one terrible thing. Human trafficking is awful. We should be able to talk about that too. So sometimes people, I think, are trying to get at that, and that's fine. But this whole thing of you can't be pro-life unless we agree on these stuff, and all these lists contradict each other, I think is not helpful. I think the worst argument that pro-life people sometimes make to pro-choice people is what we call the Beethoven argument. Abortion's wrong because maybe Beethoven could have been killed, or the cure of cancer could have been killed, or Jesus could have been killed in one youth pastor his sermon illustration I saw one time, which is a terrible argument for lots of – and Donald Trump actually used this argument on CBN when he first explained why he was pro-life. He told a story of some couple who that he knew that thought about maybe having an abortion and then didn't and are now happy that they did. This is not a good argument. We should be arguing that human beings are equally valuable because of the kinds of things they are. It's not what are people going to end up doing with their lives later. Like this argument works both ways. You know, what about people who would grow up to be rapists or something like that? I wouldn't say that they should be aborted either. This is an argument that actually plays into the pro-choice mindset that your value comes from what you can do functionally or what you do for society, as opposed to what we ought to be saying, which is all humans are equally viable because of the kind of thing we are.
All right, friends, I know that you want more of that, and you can get it at equalrightsinstitute.com. Not only the Beethoven argument and the fetal tunnel syndrome argument, but you can get the Brahms argument. Josh Brahms is the president of the Equal Rights Institute. Josh, thank you so much for being with us today on Connecting Faith.
Thanks so much for having me.
Hey, friends, we'll be right back to make the connecting point. You're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBerge.
I wanna be different, I wanna be changed, till all of me is gone, and all that remains is a fire so bright.
Hey friends, that's my heart's desire for myself. I hope it's your heart's desire for yourself as well, that every single day, moment by moment, we are being cooperative with the Holy Spirit at work within us, bringing us into ever greater conformity with who Christ is, that there is genuinely less of us and more of Christ every single moment because of the work, the active work, the present power of God at work within us by the Holy Spirit. So you are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. This is the point in the program where we like to make the connecting point. I'm actually going to let somebody else make the connecting point today. Mike Powers from Faith Radio's Madison stations, Faith 104.7 and Life 102.5, had the opportunity to talk with Hall of Fame NFL coach Joe Gibbs. They were in Madison. It was around a recent game plan for life event, and I just want to share that interview with you.
Coach, thanks for taking a few moments for us today.
You bet. Hey, we've had fun this morning, and it was neat. We had a packed house, and I had a chance to meet a lot of people up here, and most of them were Packer fans, but we still got along pretty good.
Coach, what brings you to Madison is the game plan for life. And for our listeners that may not know about that, tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, we have a website, gameplanforlife.com. We have a book. We have a small group study. We give away Bibles on that website. And basically what the ministry is, we travel around the country giving our testimony. We go to a city, we don't ask them for anything, we'll pay for half of everything, and we just need a committee there to work with us. I come and give a testimony, and we try and invite unsaved, and then we have each table host has follow-up. And so with that, we also have a prison ministry, and we normally like to try and visit a prison when we're in that area.
And Coach, with events like this, how many do you think you do in a year's time?
We probably do between 7 and 10, something like that.
Wow. And with your plate still full with NASCAR racing, and we think of you as a football coach primarily, but tell us about some of the other ventures of life.
Now, for me, right now it's all NASCAR. We got both my boys work with me in racing, and we're there in Charlotte. We've got, you know, a huge effort there. We have four cars in Cup. We have three in Xfinity. We have an ARCA program. We have two motocross bikes. We got all kinds of stuff going on. A lot of people working on cars and bikes and all kinds of racing.
Coach, finally, as you share about the game plan for life and your success in football and in racing and in a variety of different things, your faith in the Lord Jesus Christ is really the crux of it all, isn't it?
Well, for me, I shared this morning the most important thing that's ever been shared with me, and that was my testimony that leads to anybody in there making a commitment to follow Christ. And what I basically say to them, there's only two teams in the game of life. You either play for God forever. He said he makes us with a soul that lasts forever, or you play against him forever, and I don't think anybody wants to do that. And so I just say to people, can you point to a specific time and place in your life where you ask Christ to come into your life, forgive you of your sins, and be your Lord and personal Savior? If you had your seal, it's awesome. And if you hadn't, and you haven't done that, then we have a little prayer. And God has promised if you pray that prayer, just asking Him to forgive you of your sins and come into your life, be your Lord and personal Savior, He'll do that. And from that point on, you're sealed. You're His. And you're going to spend eternity with Him as opposed to playing against Him forever. So I kind of shared that. I compare life, the game of life, at the game of football. And I say you got to have a great head coach. You got a head coach that cares for us. It's a team sport. There's a clock ticking on all of us. And then you need a game plan. And that's the Bible for life. And so I kind of compare all those things to football.
All right, friends, you're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBurge. That was a recorded conversation that took place in Madison, Wisconsin. Mike Powers is a Faith Radio guy. He's at Faith 104.7 and Life 102.5. So a little shout out to our Madison listeners. And that was a conversation that Mike had with Hall of Fame NFL coach and Gibbs Racing owner Joe Gibbs, surrounding the recent game plan for life event there in Madison. And so I wanted to lift that up to you because, first of all, I think it asks really provocative questions. Like, what is your game plan for life? Are you just playing games with God? Are you actually, like, know you are playing with and for God forever? Like, that is a really provocative question. Because if I'm not for Him, then I'm against Him. Like, there's really only two teams. I think Joe's right when he points that out. And then I also think that you and I can take it a little bit further than that. And I'm sure that Joe does this in his book and at his events, but I just thought that as a jumping off point for conversation, you and I could talk about, you know, well, hey, when we think about all of the individual talents that a person brings to a team, if it's a team sport, which Christianity is, by the way, it's a team sport. Individual salvation is really important, but the reality that we as Christians then become a part of a body of believers, the very body of Christ in the world today, and that when each part is actually doing its part with responsibility connected to the head, who is Jesus, then we actually function appropriately and build the body up in love. When we don't do our part, we somebody else has to carry our dead weight. So I want you to just, you know, imagine for a moment you are playing football and only half of the people are actually doing what they're supposed to be doing and everybody else is just sitting there watching, or you have to carry them with you to get them where we're all intended to be working together to go. And that's not, you know, not in terms of like getting to heaven together, but actually bringing forth kingdom principles in the context of the real world right here in the field of play today. So it's not as if we're going to play football when we get to heaven. That's not Joe Gibbs' point, and that's certainly not the point of Scripture. It's about playing now. It's about actually getting into the game now, suiting up, being covered with Christ, taking off all of those trappings of a life without God, and actually putting on all of those things that become a part of the life of the believer. And there's lots of those lists in the New Testament. And so your individual talents matter, but this is a team sport. And, you know, are you like really seeking to advance the team or just yourself in all of this? That's really important as well. There are rules. There's rules to the game. No matter what game you're playing, there's rules. And then there's freedom within those boundaries, right? So there are some rules related to football, but there's a whole lot of freedom within the boundaries of those rules. I think that's a good conversation to have with people about the Christian experience. So the real question is, do you have a game plan? And you've got a game plan that's actually going to work itself out before time runs out. And that's not a question about time runs out in our own lives, as much as it is a question about, you know, time is actually like running out. Like, you and I, we should be compelled to share the good news of the gospel with other people because time is short. I don't know how short, but it's short. So this is a good example. I think that this very short interview that features Joe Gibbs is a really good example of using your platform and your own life experience during every season of your life in ways that honor Jesus. So let's get back to the basics if necessary, and let's actually know what we're talking about in terms of our Christian witness And then let's get out there and do it. I mean, you know, it's almost football season. Let's get in the game. All right, friends, you have been listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LeBurge. Visit us online at reconnectwithcarmen.com and at myfaithradio.com. Have a great weekend, and God bless. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.